18 April 1942, barely 4 months after the savage attack on Pearl Harbor, 80 remarkably brave Americans launched the first counterattack on the Empire of Japan. I'm Oliver North, and in this War Stories podcast, you're going to hear from the extraordinary heroes who became known as the Doolittle Raiders. They were all volunteers, handpicked shortly after we declared war on Japan. Every one of them were chosen from U.S. Army Air Corps B-25 bomber crews by legendary aviator Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle. They trained for months in secret without ever being told where they would be going or when or what they would be doing other than to constantly practice short field takeoffs, long-range navigation without landmarks, and low-level bombing runs. Even when their 16 Army Air Corps B-25s were loaded on the flight deck of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier, the USS Hornet, they thought they were being transported to a Pacific island. Only Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle and the U.S. Navy commanders of the Hornet Task Force knew the mission. Launch from the carrier, a feat never before attempted by any Army aircraft, much less a twin-engine medium bomber, fly more than 650 miles across open ocean, and drop their bombs on military targets in Tokyo and four other Japanese cities. This podcast is a treasure. Mark it for your children and grandchildren so they too can hear the voices of these legendary aviators. In the darkest days of World War II, they restored the confidence of a shaken nation and began to change the course to victory. Books have been written and Hollywood has versions of this story, but in this podcast, you'll hear the voices of courageous Americans who looked me in the eye while telling their story. There's nothing like what you're about to hear in this podcast anywhere else. So strap on your parachute harness, fasten your seatbelt. You're about to hear from the extraordinary men who carried out this impossible mission and live to tell about it. The Doolittle Raiders.
Good evening, I'm Oliver North, and welcome to War Stories. This is a B-25 Mitchell bomber. 16 warplanes, just like this one, flew into history on April 18, 1942, barely 4 months after Pearl Harbor. The mission? Payback. Surprise the enemy and bomb downtown Tokyo. For all intents and purposes, what 80 brave men from the Army Air Corps were being asked to do looked like a suicide mission. Imagine being asked to fly this big bomber, loaded down with a ton of bombs and thousands more pounds of fuel, off the deck of a pitching aircraft carrier. Oh yeah, no one had ever tried it before. They were the Doolittle Raiders, named for their leader, the daring aviation pioneer, Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle. Hollywood's often told the story of these brave men, but tonight, you'll hear the real story of the Doolittle Tokyo Raiders, from the men themselves, and in their own words. These are the men who restored the confidence of a shaken nation and changed the course of the Second World War. On that fateful morning, December 7th, 1941, Japanese dive bombers turned Pearl Harbor into a blazing inferno and struck fear into the hearts of millions of Americans. In less than 4 hours, Japan became the dominant naval and air power in the Pacific.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Army and Navy recruiting stations are stormed by hosts of American youth. New York recruiting officers have a busy time signing them up.
The public wanted revenge, and FDR pushed his generals for a bombing attack on Japan.
He never said how to do it. He just wanted them to figure out some way to fight back and to prove that we could fight back.
We were stationed at Pendleton, Oregon, the 17th Bomb Group.
And we were at Marge Field, and we had planned to do maneuvers for a couple of weeks later.
There were difficult challenges ahead. Navy bombers at a relatively short range, and it would be almost impossible to get our aircraft carriers close enough to Japan without being sunk. But then a Navy captain, Francis Lowe, had a brilliant idea.
And he saw two Army bombers taking off from a practice field that the Navy used for their young pilots to take off and take and carrier deck distances. And that night, he approached Admiral King, the Chief of Naval Operations, and said, "Sir, I saw some Army bombers taking off from the field, and I'm wondering, would it be possible for Army bombers to take off from a carrier?"
No one had ever tried it before, but if it worked, those much longer-range Army bombers could surprise the Japanese, and they'd launch from far out at sea where the carriers would be safe. King bumped the idea to General Henry Hap Arnold, the Army Air Force Chief of Staff. Arnold immediately called his friend, Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle.
The Doolittle Raiders will tell you he was the greatest pilot in the world.
Jimmy Doolittle was one of the great aviators of the 20s and 30s, you know. And we were to find out he was also a great leader.
Everybody knew Jimmy Doolittle. Airplane races were one of America's most popular sports in the 1920s, and Doolittle had won almost every trophy there was.
With the Schneider, Mackey, Bendix, and Thompson trophies to his credit, there's not much he hasn't done in blazing his trails through the sky.
But he was no ordinary daredevil. Doolittle had a PhD in engineering from MIT, and working for Shell Oil had helped develop the first high-octane fuel for aircraft. And in 1929, he was the first pilot to take off, fly a course, and land with a hood covering the cockpit, using instruments alone to guide him.
Airplanes in those days could not fly through weather, clouds, or at night, so therefore there were no scheduled operations that you could depend on.
That all changed thanks to Jimmy Doolittle. Now Hap Arnold was giving him a new challenge.
Hap asked him, "Do we have a bomber that could take off in less than 500 feet and carry a 2,000-pound bomb?" So Jimmy said, "Well, I don't think we have anyone except the B-25.
The B-25 was a relatively new twin-engine land-based bomber built by California's North American Aviation.
The B-25 was selected because it was small, because it had the sufficient range to carry 2,000-pound bombs, 2,000 miles, and because it took off and handled very well.
Now what Doolittle needed for the dangerous mission was men, 80 of them, or rather 79, since the 45-year-old pilot had convinced his superiors that he would have to lead the attack, not just plan it.
First, I found out what B-25 unit that had the most experience and called for volunteers.
That group was the 17th Bombardment Group stationed at Pendleton Field, Oregon.
We had the attitude that, you know, we can do it.
Lieutenant Bobby Height was a farm boy from Texas. He became the 21-year-old co-pilot in a crew of five with pilot Bill Farrow, navigator George Barr, gunner Harold Spatz, and bombardier Jacob DeShazer, who had some trouble with the official crew photo.
I move over and I stand right in front of the insignia on Bobby Height's uniform. Bobby says, "Get over there." And I get over there a little way, and the photographer say, "Get back." And so finally I got back behind Bobby, and that seemed to suit him. That's why that was like it was.
Sergeant Jake DeShazer from Salem, Oregon, was a camp cook for sheep herders before he joined the Army Air Corps in 1940 at the age of 27. And was a bombardier when Jimmy Doolittle came calling 2 years later.
We got orders to fly down to Columbia, South Carolina. And when we got there, we were asked to volunteer for a mission.
Lieutenant Tom Griffin, 24, from Green Bay, Wisconsin, was navigator on crew number 9.
They sent 20 crews that they picked out and sent us down to Eglin Field, Florida.
We were there about the month of March.
Jimmy Doolittle chose 26-year-old Dick Cole as his co-pilot. The plane's navigator was Henry Potter, 22, from South Dakota. And what was the navigator's first impression of his co-pilot?
You know, you got to fly with this fella. No, I think I had a good impression.
For weeks, Cole, Potter, and the other Raiders practiced short takeoffs at Eglin Field. These are pictures of those secret training flights. But Tom Griffin was one of the only Raiders to discover what the mission really was.
Doolittle sent me and Davy Jones, another one of our boys, up to Washington, D.C. in the middle of February. There were two men in Air Force intelligence that knew what we wanted. They didn't know just why we wanted it at that time.
They were there to get maps and photographs of the Japanese cities they'd bombed.
They changed the lock on one of the office doors, and the four of us got these materials together in there.
Five different places were picked to make sure the enemy propaganda machine couldn't hide the attack from its people. The last week of March, Doolittle sent the Raiders from Florida to California, where a ship was waiting to take them to sea. He told them to practice low-level flying. The young daredevils had no trouble hot-dogging it all across the country.
What altitude do you have us at? 100 feet? 100 feet? Minimum altitude.
In our plane, we flew down through the Grand Canyon and up down the Sacramento Valley at about 10 feet and had the farmers ducking and falling down. We went over to Alameda Naval Air Station. Some of the boys went under the bridges. They weren't supposed to do that, of course. But I guess they figured, well, what are they going to do to us?
So you go out to Alameda. You're out at the Naval Air Station in Alameda. There's the brand new carrier, the Hornet.
Mother Hornet, which will carry a swarm of smaller Hornets. Aircraft carriers are of increasing importance as warplanes take a greater part in battles on the ocean. The cost of that monster, $31 million.
By now, everybody's figured out we're going to take these Army Air Corps airplanes and put them aboard that ship.
That's right.
Anybody say, hey, this is crazy?
Doolittle said, we're going to do a mission here that I think we can all do. And everybody followed him. Another leader might not have gotten us to believe everything that he got us to believe.
Japanese picket ships spot the Hornet task force, and Jimmy Doolittle has to make a split-second life-or-death decision for his Raiders. That's next on War Stories. April 1st, 1942, 16 Doolittle B-25s are loaded on the deck of the 809-foot carrier Hornet. Even though it was a top-secret mission, Captain Mark Mitcher set sail from San Francisco in broad daylight.
We were very cognizant of spies in those days.
At 9 o'clock, we were going out under the Golden Gate Bridge. And there were hundreds of people up lining it. We thought every 10th one was a Japanese spy, of course.
This was the top-secret mission plan. Task Force 16-2, made up of the Hornet and seven escort ships, would head west from California. From Pearl Harbor, eight ships of Task Force 16-1, led by the carrier Enterprise, would cruise to a rendezvous point deep in the Pacific. Total radio silence was crucial. Altogether, the 10,000-man task force would then race through the Pacific to 400 miles off the Japanese coast. There, the 16 Army bombers would launch from the Hornet's deck, something that had never been done before. It was a one-way mission. After dropping their bombs, the planes were supposed to fly some 800 miles to Chuchao, China. There, in the backyard of Japanese-occupied territory, they'd refuel and escape. But as they left port, none of the Hornet's crew knew the real reason why they were transporting Army bombers.
And they were very upset because a naval ship is crowded anyway. When we got about an hour out past the Golden Gate Bridge, the speaker came on and said, now hear this, this task force is going to Japan.
And there was a great big enthusiastic holler.
After they made the announcement, as I recall, it was a completely different attitude.
They were so good with us, they even let us play poker with us and won most of our money in the 17 days without it.
Meanwhile, Colonel Jimmy Doolittle's crews continued to work on their planes. Parts were even delivered by blimp. To stretch the plane's range so they could reach China, he had to make major modifications.
To carry additional gas tanks in the bomb bay and in the crawlway between the front and back of the airplane.
The radios were taken out.
And because we didn't have a tail gun in the original B-25B, he had broomsticks cut out, painted black. We had two of them protruding from the rear end of each one of our to scare the Japanese pursuit pilots.
Then 17 days into their mission, 250 miles short of their planned takeoff point, their luck ran out. They were spotted by a Japanese picket ship.
And the picket ships were fishing boats, but they were also out there to report any enemy activity.
The cruiser Nashville fired on
them. And I could see it was sinking.
They knew their cover was blown. Doolittle and the task force leader, Admiral William Halsey, faced a tough decision. The mission would have to be moved up at least 12 hours, and the distance to fly increased by 250 miles.
The thing that was kind of eerie in all of our minds, would we have enough fuel?
Now there was almost no chance they could reach China. It was looking more and more like a suicide mission.
And then right away they announced over a PA system,
Army personnel, man your airplane, take off immediately.
Airmen and sailors sprang into action. But high winds and heavy swells were tossing the ships about like toy boats.
The sea was running high enough where water was coming up over the bow.
And no one had ever taken off in an overloaded bomber from a pitching deck of an aircraft carrier.
Out of gas, one by one, the Doolittle planes fall out of the sky. What happened to the Doolittle Raiders? Coming up on War Stories.
The 16 Doolittle planes were lined up ready to launch in America's first offensive action of World War II. But would the heavily loaded planes make it off the deck? Jimmy Doolittle and his crew went first.
And we were all watching pretty close because they only had about 400 feet per takeoff on that aircraft carrier.
We got off in a good short distance, in fact, well before the end of the carrier.
But when Doolittle got up, we all let out a big cheer, and we knew it could be done.
One by one, the 16 B-25s, each carrying five men, roared into the stormy skies. But one pilot, Ted Lawson, forgot to lower his flaps.
When he went off, he went down, down, down. And he just about touched the water, and we were really worried about him. But he made it fine. Directly pulled up, you know, and everybody cheered.
Then, just before the last plane, carrying co-pilot Bob Height and bombardier Jacob DeShazer could leave, there was an accident.
One of the Navy men fell into our prop.
His arm was in one place and his body was over here.
We thought that we had killed him, you know. So happened that he only lost an arm, but we didn't actually know this until the war was over.
While the planes raced toward Japan, the carrier task force made a sharp U-turn and headed for home. The Raiders were now completely on their own. On the morning of April 18th, a routine air raid drill was underway in Tokyo. The Japanese had no idea that a real air raid was about to happen. Skimming just above the waves to avoid detection, Doolittle's bomber was the first to reach shore.
When we pulled up, it was somewhere around 1,500 feet. Where we got over the main section of the city. And Fred Bramer dropped the bombs and we went right back down on the deck.
America's first offensive action of World War II had just begun and the Japanese had been caught completely by surprise. At least at first.
Now the other eight planes had gotten in there, of course, ahead of us, almost near an hour. And of course, the Japanese were quite ready for plane number 9.
Are you picking up enemy fire? Are you seeing enemy airplanes?
They had all of their anti-aircraft units shooting. And they had to depress their guns to shoot at our planes because we were at rooftop level. And some of our boys actually saw anti-aircraft shells from those guns exploding in the streets. They probably did as much damage to the city as we did.
The Raiders had hit all five target cities, Tokyo, Yokohama, Kobe, Nagoya, and Osaka. They now hightailed it west to China.
And yet, perhaps in many respects, the most difficult part of your mission is now ahead of you.
Yeah.
Trying to get to China. And there's no real certainty that's going to happen.
No, we really thought we couldn't get to the China coast.
Most of the planes were over the China Sea with 1,000 miles to go and only 800 miles worth of fuel.
Going down the coast of Japan, I realized that there might be short of fuel, short of being able to get to China proper.
Well, when Hank gave us the good news, that's when the old man told everybody we were going to practice our get ready for a ditching procedure.
So we really tried to take care of the fuel.
Then something almost miraculous happened. They ran into a freak storm that literally pushed them over China.
That type of wind was very unusual for that time of year particularly.
But homing beacons that were supposed to guide the planes to airfields in China were never turned on. The Raiders were lost at night in a storm 10,000 miles from home.
We could hardly see our wingtips. All we knew was we couldn't get to Chuchao, our airport.
And so fuel gauges are going toward empty.
Oh, sure, sure.
And
when they empty, we're going to bail out. That's all we could do.
Did they actually flame out first, or did he just say it's time to go?
They start sputtering. We were out of gas. We were all ready. We had our chutes and everything. We were ready to go.
The red warning lights came on, and then Bill and I decided, let's bail out. So we ordered the crew to bail out.
The co-pilot, Bobby Hyde, said, Jake, you're first. And I was wishing somebody to go first, because I didn't know how to do it.
None of us ever had bailed out before. Tom, what were you thinking? If you stay in this plane, you're dead. It didn't take any bravery to jump out of the airplane because that's the only chance you had to live. So you're thinking, well, I hope this chute opens.
News of the raid boosts the morale of a gloomy America, but for Jacob DeShazer, Bob Hyde, and other Raiders, their struggle for survival is just beginning. That's next on War Stories.
Must have been 130 mile an hour wind, you know. It just knocked me right back against the fuselage.
One by one, the Raider planes ran out of fuel over China, forcing the crews to jump into the pitch black night, into a raging storm, and possibly into enemy hands.
And it was such a peculiar sensation, bailing out in a storm like that. It was a big storm. And you were in an entirely black void. Couldn't see a thing, and I felt my chute open, of course. There's a big jerk that you get when it opens. And it would go over here, and it would fold up, and I think, I'm losing my air. And then it would come up, fill up, and go over on the other side and collapse. If we'd hit the side of a mountain in one of those, it would have been curtains. But gradually, as you approach the earth, these vertical currents abate. And the first indication I had I was near the ground, a branch of a tree hit my face.
Then, sure enough, I hit the highest ground. It was all underwater there, up some kind of a rice field.
Cracked my ankle pretty good.
Hank Potter was discovered by suspicious Chinese troops who took his and a crewmate's guns.
We decided that the best thing for us to do is try to get one of those guns back and at least fight. We're going to die out there. Die fighting.
Meanwhile, a few hours later, Doolittle found the wreckage of their plane and slumped to the ground.
Doolittle was just heartbroken because he's, as far as he was concerned, he had failed in his mission.
Figured he'd lost all of his airplanes, he lost his men, and he figured that this is enough to get him court-martialed.
Over the next few days, Chinese civilians helped Doolittle's crews slip away from Japanese patrols.
And they put us in a kind of a river junk boat to keep us moving. The Japanese patrol boats were going up and down the thing and the searchlights and everything.
Tokyo bombed. In Chungking, Madame Chiang Kai-shek honored Doolittle and his men.
Once in free China, Doolittle found most of his crews and realized the mission was in fact a success. There was no court-martial. Instead,
he was promoted from lieutenant colonel to brigadier general.
The Japanese people were stunned by the raids. Japanese propaganda falsely claimed they'd shot down 9 of the B-25s, but the psychological damage was done.
Well, they were deeply shocked and humiliated because they had told the Japanese people that they could never be attacked. Their reaction was one of great fury and great humiliation.
Back home, there was jubilation, but FDR kept almost all details secret, claiming that the planes had come from Shangri-La, the mythical paradise in James Hilton's novel, Lost Horizon.
Several thousand casualties and fires burned for days. The Japs were utterly mystified. Ah, wouldn't they like to know just where those American bombers came from?
Leaking fuel, plane number 8, piloted by Ski York, headed to nearby Russia, not China. He landed safely near Vladivostok.
The 5 men were put in house arrest over in western Russia, and they finally escaped into Iran after about 14 months of internment.
4 of the raider planes chose to ditch or crash land along the Chinese coast.
And that was dangerous. Ted Lawson, who wrote the book 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, saw a smooth sandy beach and he tried to land. He put his wheels down, hit the whitecaps, and they cartwheeled in. Unfortunately, they all lived. But they're all bunged up pretty bad.
Another raider, Doc White, later had to amputate Lawson's leg. For about 10 days, the Chinese hid Lawson's crew and about a dozen other raiders in a mountainside shelter along the coast. By May, those raiders were back in Allied hands. But the crew of Plane 6 wasn't so lucky. It also ditched in the ocean.
2 men died swimming to shore.
And pilot Dean Hallmark, co-pilot Robert Meter, and navigator Chase Nielsen fell into the hands of the Japanese. About 300 miles inland, Height, DeShazer, and the rest of their crew suffered the same fate. The Japanese wasted no time in parading the captured raiders in front of the cameras for these propaganda films.
You know, we had on black blindfolds, all of us, so we couldn't see what was happening.
Well, I felt lower in the snake's belly when I realized I was in their hand, and I'd let them take me.
In all, 8 raiders were in the hands of the Japanese, and they were furious at the American airmen.
And they put us on their plane and took us to Tokyo.
Because of the raid, Japan eventually reserved its worst torture for captured American airmen. Some were cut up by medical students while still alive. Others were stabbed, beheaded, or beaten to death in front of crowds of civilians just for sport.
They had a little piece of wood that had been sawed from one corner to the other, you know. My legs were right on the sharp edge. And then here come the club. Bang! It hit me on the side of the head.
Well, they were given a water torture where they're laid on the ground and bound, and they pour water down their nose and down their throat until they almost drown.
And it would go down your nose, you'd kind of strangle, you know. But I don't think it made me say any more than I say it anyhow.
In June, they were sent back to China and put on trial. By now, all were starving and sick.
I got a fever and dysentery while I was in there, and I didn't think I was going to make it at all.
And they were accused of killing school children and bombing only schools and hospitals, and that they were all to suffer for it.
After the trial, the court's decision was read in Japanese without translation. The men didn't know it yet, but all had been sentenced to death.
Just ahead, the Japanese take their revenge on the Chinese who helped the raiders, slaughtering thousands of men, women, and children. We'll also tell you about one of the best-kept secrets of the war, a Japanese balloon bomb offensive on the U.S. mainland prompted by the Doolittle raid. Don't go anywhere.
Japan committed the most horrific atrocities in 1937 when it invaded Nanking, then China's capital. More than 300,000 men, women, and children were savagely killed. Many buried or burned alive. As many as 80,000 women were brutally raped and then mutilated. And in late April 42, the Japanese repeated these atrocities against any Chinese who'd helped Doolittle's Tokyo Raiders.
And if there was any evidence in a city or a town or a village that they went through that Americans had been there, they would slaughter everybody in the town.
The relentless carnage claimed the lives of 250,000 Chinese in just 3 months.
The Doolittle Raiders' bombing of Tokyo affected headquarters more than the Japanese nation.
Takeshi Maruyama was piloting a Japanese torpedo bomber when he learned of the raid. He was told to chase the carrier task force, but couldn't find them. He says his military leaders wanted quick revenge for the attack.
We finally came to the agreement of the Midway battle.
They decided that they would change their tactics, their strategy, and to attack Midway Island.
That would turn out to be a deadly mistake.
One of the greatest blows of devastation ever struck in ocean warfare.
They also mounted a bizarre plan to get back at America with a balloon bomb offensive.
And these were bombs that were attached to balloons.
In 1944-45, the Japanese sent thousands of the 32-foot diameter balloons soaring on the jet stream to the western U.S.
Well, about 250 of them did land, and six people were killed in Oregon at a picnic.
No one else died, but even today, the danger still exists.
Many of those bombs may still be somewhere and still may be lethal.
On October 15, 1942, Japanese prison guards took 21-year-old gunner Harold Spatz, 26-year-old pilot William Farrow, and 28-year-old pilot Dean Hallmark from their cells to a nearby cemetery. There, they were tied to three crosses, and each was shot once in the forehead.
We didn't know that this happened.
And it would be months before anyone back home found out. Pilot Ted Lawson, recovering from his amputation in Washington, reacted emotionally to the news.
We knew their families, their children, and if there's any way to get even, we'll certainly try.
A year later, another of the raiders still rotting in a wretched Japanese prison died.
We lost Bob Meter to dysentery and beriberi December the 1st of 1943.
Now it was just Bob Height, Jake DeShazer, Chase Nielsen, and George Barr.
And after we lost Bob Meter, we really thought that the rest of us were going to go the same way, you know.
No one at home knew where they were or even if they were still alive. So they carved messages into the wooden planks of their prison floor and prepared for the end.
We asked for the Bible. And each of us read the Bible through completely.
The amazing story of Jacob DeShazer's return to Japan as a missionary and how he changed the life of the man who led the attack on Pearl Harbor. That's just ahead on War Stories.
Japan made a major miscalculation when it tried to take America's Midway Island in June of 1942. Admiral Yamamoto's Navy lost four carriers, hundreds of planes, and thousands of men. Japan never recovered from the defeat.
So you can say that the Doolittle Raid changed the course of the war in the Pacific by provoking the Midway battle.
When he got home in May of 42, FDR presented Jimmy Doolittle with the nation's highest award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. But the raiders were stunned to be hailed as heroes.
You really had no idea of the extraordinary effect of this raid on the psyche, the sense of determination of the American people to get home.
We didn't know it till we landed in Washington, D.C.
At Bowling Air Force Base.
Right here at Bowling Air Force Base. That's where we got our distinguished flying crosses.
General Hap Arnold and Doolittle handed out the prestigious medal outside a hangar at the airfield. We went back there to that same spot 60 years later to speak with Tom.
Jimmy Doolittle is awarded the Medal of Honor. You're given the Distinguished Flying Cross, the nation's second highest award for valor. And you guys then go off to fight the rest of the war.
That's right. Yeah. They didn't send us home. That's for sure. Yeah.
By July of 1943, of the five of us, two had been shot down and were killed, and the other three of us were in German prison camps.
Tom was shot down over Sicily and spent the rest of the war in Stalag Luft III, the German POW camp made famous in the movie The Great Escape.
I can't complain because it was so much better than being a prisoner of the Japanese.
August 14th, 1945. As America celebrated the end of World War II, the four surviving Raiders were being liberated from their brutal captors. Emaciated and weary, Chase Nielsen, Bob Hite, and Jacob DeShazer were surprised and overjoyed to taste the freedom of home.
And we're certainly glad to be back in the good old USA.
Coming back to God's country is just what the doctor ordered.
Besides a dramatic weight loss, DeShazer had experienced a religious awakening in prison. It came all at once one day after months of reading the Bible.
When I put that all together, that morning of the 8th of June, 1944, boy, the Holy Spirit just seemed to come into that prison cell.
He decided to become a missionary, and of all places, Japan. In 1948, he went back with his family and stayed there for 30 years.
I felt like that was the best thing I could do.
There he met Captain Mitsuo Fushida, the man who led the raid on Pearl Harbor. Amazingly, DeShazer converted him to Christianity, and they became lifelong friends.
George didn't get to come home. He was with us.
For Hite's navigator, George Barr, the struggle continued.
George was the one that was in the most serious physical condition when they were released.
He was not able to fly home with us.
He started to have hallucinations.
He thought it was a Japanese trick and that he was not free.
And he thought about it a while and then he thought, I gotta kill myself.
Just 28 when he was released, Barr tried unsuccessfully to hang himself. Soon after, his papers were lost and he fell through the cracks and ended up being shipped to a hospital in Iowa. One of the war's greatest heroes had simply disappeared. After weeks and weeks of searching, Jimmy Doolittle finally found him. He was in terrible shape.
He didn't know what he'd been promoted. He didn't have any pay. He didn't have any status at all. He's just a patient in this hospital. So, Jimmy Doolittle, he got there, found this condition. He went to the hospital commander, and it isn't known what was said. Suddenly, George had status as an officer with a promotion and with a couple of $1,000 in pay coming to him, and was put on the road to recovery.
How the Raiders pay tribute to the memory of Jimmy Doolittle and the other fallen Raiders. That's next on War Stories.
The Doolittle Raiders have remained close and see each other at a formal reunion every year.
We just kind of look forward to it. It's kind of like being of one family, you know.
Oh, yeah. We've known each other's children and our grandchildren, and it's like a big family.
A big part of each reunion is the cup ceremony, a set of 80 silver cups, one for each man, and a special bottle of brandy is kept at the Air Force Academy.
Those cups have been flown to each reunion, and the fellas drink a toast to those who have gone. And if anybody has died in the interim, his cup is turned down by a member of his crew.
Doolittle's own cup has been upside down since he died in 1993 at the age of 96. For the Doolittle boys, it was like losing a dad. all remember him fondly.
He was a big man and a little man in the body.
Great man and great leader.
He was the most gentle fellow.
And I think we all had a great respect and love for him. And I think he respected and loved each of us.
In fact, Doolittle paid for their first reunion in 1945 in Miami with his own money.
We had some good parties.
Apparently they went skinny dipping in the pool, in the hotel pool, and maybe raised too much cane.
No, I didn't participate in those wild activities.
I kept in front of them.
That night, the night watchman was so upset that these guys breaking all the rules, they wrote a note to the day manager. Said, this is the toughest night I've ever had in my career. So when the day manager got this note from the night manager, he showed it to General Doolittle. And the manager said, don't worry about it. These guys, for what they did, have the right to make all the noise they want in the Sartell.
For what they did, the Doolittle Raiders have earned an honored place in our country's history, one that will live on long after the last of their cups is finally turned over.
How do you want to be remembered?
Well, as men that did their duty, saw their duty, what they had to do, and did it without any question. There was no question who our enemies were and where they were, and we were going to go after them. We could. And we did.
To a man, the Doolittle Raiders still refuse to accept accolades as heroes. They say they had a job to do, and they did it. But these 80 men took on all of Japan and did what no one had ever done before. Their amazing mission revived this nation in one of its darkest hours. Six decades later, their humble determination and courage remain a shining example of what makes this country worth fighting for. If that's not heroism, I don't know what is. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.